Hollywood is rated LGBT radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
And welcome to this installment of Rated LGBT Radio. We have a great show lined up for you today. One of the things I love to do beginning of October every year is love to kick off the month with a Halloween-ish themed show. Last year, we tried to get on somebody from the cast of, and I'm going to forget the name of the show now, but it was a Netflix show that was LGBTQ Ghost Hunters. And it was a series that Kristen Stewart was the executive producer of. We tried to get the cast on for you beginning of last October because it would have been a great Halloween show. But unfortunately, it was right during the actors' strike, and the cast felt that they couldn't come on because that would be promoting, it'd be crossing lines of the strike, et cetera. So I ended up writing an article about that show, but we didn't get to do it on the podcast. Well, that was then, this is now, and we have a wonderful show to kick off the Halloween season with a film called Witchy Ways. And it is an independent film. I believe it is just now starting to get its feet wet across the film circuits or film festivals. Obviously witches are part of it, thus the title, but it's not your scary witch, you know, Blair Witch Project type of witches. It is also not your campy hocus pocus kind of witches either. It rides the rails between those kind of genres. And if you remember the film Practical Magic with Sandra Bullock and Nicole Kidman, it is more in line with that kind of depiction, where it is magical, whimsical, but, and for witchcraft, more down to earth and almost realistic. It has a lot of depth to it, explanations behind what witchcraft philosophies, the real ones, are, yet it still has kind of that magical flair to it. Today our guest is the mother of the film, the director, writer, and producer, Jane Clark. Jane has got a very impressive independent film pedigree. She's done numerous feature films, as well as she's the queen of independent short films, having won numerous awards for all of those. She started out as an actress, which that's near and dear to my heart. I love actors who then explore into other parts of the creative process. The film itself is about a young woman named Eve, and Eve is a marketing person. She's in the rat race, but she decides to quit all of that. She has a family tragedy that she is carrying with her. And she goes to a remote property to kind of escape and find herself. The property owner is another beautiful woman named Danny. Sparks are flying between the two of them. And it gets a little bit weird when Danny confesses to Eve that she is a witch. And not only is she a witch, but a lot of their background kind of intertwines from their families, and all of that unfolds as their romance kind of blossoms. And that is a very simplistic overview of the film, but gives you an idea of what it is all about. So Jane is waiting in the wings. Before we go to Jane, do want to go to Brody Levesque. Brody is the co-host of the show. He is the former editor of the Los Angeles Blade magazine, and he still has his finger firmly on the touch of what is happening news-wise. So, Brody, tell us what is happening in the news.
Hey, Rob, good afternoon. And I want to make a pitch here for our listeners who were negatively impacted by this Hurricane Helene, for those, our other listeners, to give support to them. It's an utter disaster zone, particularly in North Carolina, in the mountain region of Appalachia and other places. If you'd like to help or make a donation, you can reach out to the American Red Cross or text the word Helene to 90999. That's Helene to 90999 to make a donation. You can also contact your local Salvation Army, and then you can also reach out to AmeriCares. All these organizations are in the process of helping the victims. For those in Western North Carolina, where I spent a lot of time, and I have friends there, they were particularly devastated by this. Some of those mountain towns, including Cherry Point, which I knew real well, are literally gone. Asheville, which is a beautiful and scenic city in that part of North Carolina, was also really horribly impacted by it. So for our other listeners, please reach out. And if you can give your assistance, I'm sure it would be greatly appreciated. I wanted to talk a little bit about the filing that was released by U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan in Washington yesterday. This is the filing from the special prosecutor, Jack Smith, against the former president, and it is in response to the Supreme Court ruling, which essentially said that presidents retain immunity for official acts. The Supreme Court had remanded the case back to District Judge Chutkan's court, should it, you know, move ahead, and the filing needed to be narrowed. In the filing, the special counsel made the case that the former president's efforts to overturn the election were in fact a private scheme, which was conducted by Trump and his associates. This was not an exercise of his core constitutional powers as the sitting president. And that distinction is extremely important because it moves it away from the immunity that was granted by the Supreme Court of the U.S. Among the arguments, and in the 165 pages, there's quite a bit in there, two of the major points, that Trump's January 6th speech was organized by private individuals and promoted as a campaign rally. Now, this was the speech that he gave on the Ellipse just prior to the protesters and the insurrectionists attacking the U.S. Capitol building to stop the counting and certification of the election. The other part that made it obvious, according to the special counsel, that it was in fact a campaign rally as opposed to a, quote, official act, when he took the stage, the song that played in the background was the Village People song, YMCA, which was a campaign rally song. Now, this would be opposed to the typical that if he had taken the stage in his ability and function as president, it would have been to hail to the chief. So the special counsel made those two distinctions. In the new revelations, the special counsel notes that Trump knew that his stolen election claims were false, but that he stoked unrest and schemed to overturn the results anyway. The special counsel also said that Trump relentlessly pursued then Vice President Pence to, quote, do whatever he needed to steal the election, despite Pence's repeated, you know, pushing back on him that he was going to, no, do his constitutional duty. The Trump team, which includes more than just the president in this filing, is accused of creating chaos, seeking to create chaos and confusion at polling places when votes were being tabulated. Apparently, according to the special counsel, one of Trump's aides ordered colleagues to make them riot at a voting county center as part of a plan to undermine the results. Obviously, the response from the former president basically has been, you know, he said it in an interview, he's basically been pushing back. Pardon me. He said this in an interview with News Nation on Wednesday. This is a weaponization of the government and released 30 days before the election. My poll numbers have gone up instead of down. It is pure election interference. I need to fact check the former president here. His poll numbers have slowly, slowly been going down, not tanking, but going down. The campaign is not doing as well as he claims it is. This is not a weaponization of government. So again, I'm going to push back on the former president for that. And it is also not falsehood ridden, nor is it unconstitutional. The special counsel is charging him with election interference.
Yeah, Brody, I want to make 2 points on that. One is the Justice Department did not just launch an investigation, which that's what they don't do 30 days before an election, supposedly, although they did it to Clinton. So, you know, so much for that. But supposedly they don't do that. This was in the courts, and the reason it's coming back in the courts is his own fault, because his legal team sent it to the Supreme Court, and they delayed the process, and so the timing is actually all on him. But I have to sit back and take a little perverse delight in the thing that could potentially bring down Trump is a theme song by the gay Village People, YMCA. That makes my rainbow-colored day. Thank you very much. Anyway, continue.
All right. Shifting away from the world of politics for just a moment, I should also note before I leave politics that yesterday in that same interview with News Nation, Trump was asked by the reporter if he would deport the Haitians who are legally in Springfield, Ohio, under the parole as granted by the government, and he said he absolutely would. Didn't matter to the, they were legal status. He would pick them all up and carry them back to his country, their country, rather. So, yeah, it's, you know, typical Trumpisms. Today, or a couple days ago, what day is it? Today's the 3rd. On the 1st, a couple days ago, we began the annual celebration of LGBTQ History Month. I need to note that this is the 30th year that we are celebrating it. It was started on the evening of October 3rd. Which is today. A few dozen students at the University of Missouri St. Louis campus gathered in an auditorium to kick off a film festival, to celebrate the first Lesbian Gay History Month, as it was called at the time. Well, maybe the films weren't that good, so it was a film festival. The founder was a gentleman by the name of Rodney Wilson, who was teaching social studies in 1997. At that time, LGBTQ history was literally still pretty much closeted. And so this was a significant thing. In the intervening years, of course, it has gone to become, you know, something I think of note. It's outlived a lot of, you know, hysteria, and it's outlived a lot of other nonsense. So shout out to Rodney Wilson, who's the founder, and to everybody that has propelled LGBTQ History Month forward in the month of October, which I think is critically important. October also marks on the 11th National Coming Out Day, and which is a significantly important day in our community as well. So I'd like to make a note on those two points. So happy History Month for our community. And we have one more story, which is not pleasant. I'm going to just briefly touch on it. And it was originally reported by trans journalist Aaron Reed. And essentially what has happened in the state of Texas is that the attorney general down there has offered a couple of legal opinions that the head of the Department of Public Safety, which oversees the Texas Department of Motor Vehicles, which issues documents such as driver's licenses and IDs and things like that, has decided to start reverting trans people's valid driver's licenses. Initially, they were just going to do it on renewals and applications for new licenses. That has now been extended to even look at walking back driver's licenses that have been previously issued. We're talking, you know, years of, you know, folks, you know, in their proper gender and gender markers. The new letter was from DPS Director Stephen McCraw to the Attorney General Ken Paxton. Both gentlemen are hugely anti-queer and definitely anti-trans. With this in place, they're also going to be defying court orders on name changes. Essentially, at the end of the day, it would be more or less reverting driver's licenses and state walking IDs to dead names and dead genders, and very little could be done about it. Most legal experts that I've spoken to, including Shannon Minter, who's the legal director of the National Center for Lesbian Rights, and the crew at the American Civil Liberties Union, have told me that they could see litigation on this. They're not sure how far it's going to get. They also pointed out to me, and this is something that I thought was significant, the United States passport, a federal passport, which oftentimes relies on these state driver's licenses, is kind of the holy grail of documents. However, we could see ourselves in a situation in these states like Texas, and we're also being told that Arkansas, Oklahoma, Alabama, and Louisiana are also considering this, where a United States passport would be correct with a correct gender marker and with a correct name on it, and the accompanying driver's license wouldn't be because it would be dead naming and dead gendering. So you'll have literally a real ID that you would use to get on an airplane that's incorrect and a U.S. passport that is correct. One doesn't necessarily cancel out the other one. Most of the folks that I've been talking to have said that this is going to put the trans community in a position where it would actually create forced migration, because most people aren't going to detransition over this, and so you're going to have an entire body of Americans that are just simply going to find someplace else to live, not to mention the fact there probably will be an uptick in suicide rates and other things, again, as a direct result of this transphobic hatred by these state officials in Texas, in Oklahoma, Arkansas, Louisiana, and Alabama. Shannon pointed out to me, that's also the jurisdiction of the U.S. Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which is highly conservative, hasn't been nice to our community, and so we could see this one end up at SCOTUS years down. But in the interim, the damage is already done. And that is really it for the news today.
Yeah, that just on that last story, the underlying insanity of that, other than I think the goal is exactly what you described is going to happen, which is people are going to want to migrate out of those states, and I think that is the intention, is to drive them out. But there is absolutely no core societal benefit, no matter what they think about trans people or anything like that, to this their movements on this. I mean, it's like who are they harming? I mean, if I wanted to change my name and my gender on my driver's license, who does that harm? It's insane that that's happening. Out of just pure spite and hatred. I can't wrap my mind around that. So anyway, all right. Well, let's move on to, it is the month of Halloween and witches and magic and all sorts of things, spectacle are happening. And one of those things is a new movie called Witchy Ways. And I want to welcome its creator, Jane Clark, to the show. Jane, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled to do so. So I want to kind of start out with a quote that you have on your website from Virginia Woolf, where you say, "Every secret of a writer's soul, every experience of her life, every quality of her mind is written large in her works." So you've created this wonderful, sweet film, Witchy Ways, full of witchy magic and same-sex love in a wonderful romance. What in your soul drove the creation of this movie?
Well, it was a little bit of an evolution. I was looking for the next project. I had teamed up with Maram Hassler, who plays Dani. She plays the witch. And we had decided we wanted to make something together. And I originally started with her as the lead and sort of tried to get inspired around that and got a little lost. So I started watching a lot of films and trying to, I knew I wanted to do witches because, like, in my soul, I think I'm a witch. I just haven't figured out, you know, how deeply I am. But I started researching the witch community because I realized it was actually a lot larger than I thought. And in doing that, I was struck by a couple of things. One, they're very much closeted, like the LGBTQ community, say 20 years ago. They're very scared to talk about who they are and what their life is and what they believe in. And so you don't know somebody's a witch until they feel safe enough to tell you. And there's more people out there than you can imagine. So I felt a little driven to speak for a community of people who don't have a voice right now. And the voice that's out there is Hollywood's voice, the scary witch, the over-the-top witch, but not the everyday witch.
Right.
And then in the process of that, there's a lot of me in the character of Eve. My mother, Eve's mother, passes away from an accident, but the accident occurred due to her Alzheimer's. She has early onset Alzheimer's, and I went through that with my mom. And so that's personal. I always, even if I'm kind of far reaching on the outside in terms of the icing on the film, the characters and the things that the characters explore are facets of me and things that I want to talk about. So there's a lot more in there. She was also she's a bird watcher. She collected birds and dead birds. It's really weird, but she used to stuff them for the nature center in our town. But she was an odd duck like that. And so, I mean, I didn't do literally who she was, but Eve's mom was, is into bugs. And I stretch into my own personal life to find the things that I want to express or talk about or share, because I think a lot of times, you know, people find comfort in knowing that they're not alone, whether it's going through grief or dealing with illness or, living a closeted life.
Yeah, no, definitely. In fact, it's funny because even the TV show Bewitched had this very undertone of allegory to being gay. I mean, it's like through a lot of the actors who were in it, plus the themes that you just brought up. And in the film Practical Magic, you know, one of the key moments in the film was when they call together the women of the town and they're shouting out, it's like, oh my God, they're coming out. You know, tying the coming out process with being a witch and all that. You've always been a big tie to the LGBT community. You've had Wilson Cruz in your films, who's a big, GLAAD advocate as well as an actor and very visible in media. Candace Cain has appeared in several of your films, including this one, in which she's fabulous. And she's, you know, one of the few out trans actresses. Your films have been in Outfest. What is your allegiance or tie with the LGBTQ community?
Well, it's interesting because, in a very basic way, I'm married to a man. So I've been asked the question, you know, are you straight or gay? And in the early days when I did a short film called The Touch, and then I produced a film called Elena Undone. And Elena Undone was a very popular, it was a big hit at the time it came out. It was a lesbian romance. And at that time, it seemed to me there were only two choices. You either were straight or you were gay, because bi was, a lot of lesbians didn't kind of ascribe to that. They thought that, you know, if you said you were bi, you were just denying your truth. And so I chose the easier answer or the more truthful answer, which was that I was straight because I've been in a long-term relationship with a guy. But as time has shifted and time has, you know, kind of bi visibility is much greater now and much more kind of, in fact, I think more, they say more lesbians are bi than strictly lesbian these days, at least the younger generation. I recently realized that the answer I used to give to this was not as valid because I've slept with women and I had a girlfriend for a little while and before my husband. And so I actually am a bi human being. And much of my world is filled with LGBTQ people, my friends, and a lot of them are LGBTQ. So but I will say this, you know, when I started making films for the community, it was kind of driven by things that just popped up in my life. It was less a cause. It was just, oh, here's a story I want to tell. And I don't see my films actually as being LGBTQ plus. I see them as films about human beings living their life. You know, I don't go about it in a way that I think about it as in terms of a separate community. I think of it in terms of humanity when I'm writing. So I don't know.
Which is
a long-winded way of saying.
No, it's a beautiful way of saying it because I think that's one thing about the film. Like in talking about your film, I would be hesitant to say what I think a lot of people would observe of as saying, oh, it's a lesbian love story, because neither character identifies strictly as being lesbian in the film. They fall right into the romance very naturally from a very human process with each other. But it's like, I don't know who, you know, what their whole identity is beyond that. So I think that's very true. Plus what you're saying is accurate. It's like, we're all human. And I mean, that's the, from the queer perspective, we all know that. We already knew that. But from kind of the outside looking in, it's like you got to pick your bucket, you know, and you got to go into that bucket and be that, and which is not really accurate. In fact, it leads to a lot of kind of weird things. I was actually pretty intrigued with Candace's character because also on the face of it in the movie, she is a cisgender straight woman, best friend, but then that's never actually defined. So when you were writing her character, and I know you write from, you have the vision of the people you want in the roles and you write from that, did you envision her character as being trans
no.
Or did you write her as a cisgender? Which
I wrote her as cisgender straight woman, absolutely. If you've ever met Candace, she's more feminine than I am. You know, she's just so beautiful and just such a gorgeous woman that, you know, I don't see her as a trans actress. I see her as an actress. But
right.
I didn't write anything specific because if I had hired a cisgender woman, I wouldn't put anything specific. You would just kind of assume that she was. So
right.
Why would I do that for Candace? And what I did do, though, is I took their relationship back to try to show that they were friends from a young age. And I tried to kind of, without saying it, try to set in people's minds, this is, a cisgender woman, by the fact that they knew each other when they were young. Getting caught with skinny dipping by Eve's mom. Like, I tried to set it back to a time when, at their age, if that character had been 14 or 15 and playing, you know, skinny dipping with a bunch of boys, she would almost almost definitely have been cisgender, because that time of life, that wouldn't have been, you know, nobody was transitioning as a kid back then. So I tried to do little things like that, but in the end, and it's funny, you know what, in Meth Head, I don't mention she's trans, but she does play a trans character in Meth Head, and I don't mention it, and that caused confusion because she was so beautiful that people that didn't know her as an actress didn't know who she was. So they just thought she was this straight woman, and they were like, there was a question why this beautiful woman is just living in this house with these meth addicts. And that popped up at festivals fairly often because she's just gorgeous and feminine and all that other stuff. But
Oh no, I was just saying she's gorgeous and she's funny and full of personality.
Yeah.
She's a great actress, but she's a great character in the films. But yeah, I totally relate to what you're saying. I have quite a few trans friends. But when I think about it, because there's a certain point when I'm in an argument about trans rights, you know, part of me wants to go, well, do you know any trans people? And then all of a sudden in my head, I'm going, well, wait, you don't know any trans people. And it's, which is not true. The reason my head goes there is because when I look at all my trans friends, I don't think of any of them as in transition. I see them as their real gender. It doesn't even occur to me anymore. You know, it's like that they're not cisgender. Plus, one of the things I've had a little bit of issue with in some creative venues is when a trans person is cast as a trans character and there's some line in the film or presentation where they're called out for being trans, more times than not, I'm going, how would you know? Because that feels artificial to me, because I would not know that person, their history. I just know who they are. And which is, I don't know, the people I've talked to who are trans like to be identified, or many of them, I don't want to generalize, many of them like to be identified as trans because they do want to represent the journey that they've gone through, and they want to represent that for people. But yeah, but no, in this film, in fact, I forgot Candace was trans when I watched your film. It wasn't until afterwards it was like, oh my God, you know. And so it was very, very, very seamless. So you did that so well. But I want to go to the witchcraft part of it. You both did it. I mean, let's face it, you pulled out the performances of the people. But let's go with that first. Back to what made you want to be an actress when you first started out?
Oh, you know, I don't know. I was a painter originally. I moved to New York to paint when I was 18, and I had a lot of downtime, and I thought, oh, I'll just take an acting class for fun, because a lot of my friends were actors, and I just got hooked. It's very addictive because it feels so good when you hit it, you know, when you go into the zone and you know you've just delivered a performance that's moved people, it's hugely addictive. So I kind of got drawn into it by mistake almost. And I didn't stop acting because I didn't love it. I stopped acting because I didn't like the business end of things. I didn't like the process of trying to get the job.
Yeah, it's where you have to be the product and you're out there, and it's that gets very confusing. So you were on Chicago Hope, what was that like? Was that like dream come true, or?
You know what? It wasn't. It's like a lot of disillusionment, you know. I had a small role. They kept calling me back to play. There was a nurse role, and they just kept calling me to do it. They never gave me a name, but I did 15 episodes. They just didn't want to, because if they gave me a name, they'd have to pay me as, higher level, either guest star or reoccurring, you know, and that would require paying me more. So they could get away with just paying me basic, you know, scale by just not naming me. And that was annoying, but also it was boring. Like, I mean, I would love to be on a TV show. I could see it be really exciting if you have a lead or even a strong reoccurring role, but oh my God, I mean, it was just excruciating waiting around all day long to get a couple of lines out, you know, and then it's over in a heartbeat. And I did a bunch of independent films, which I loved doing as an actor, but they were frustrating because so many of them turned out, you know, poorly. They just fell down in one or more of the elements that go into making a film. And I just, it was just disillusioning. But having said that, look, you know, Chicago Hope was fun. The cast was all super friendly. I had my own dressing room, you know, I mean, it was fun. It just wasn't creatively satisfying.
Right. No, it's, yeah. And I relate to that as being, having come from acting myself and moved into writing, I totally relate to every step of that. And, you know, writing, you know, you're in the channel, you're creating this mm-hmm. character and you don't have to break. And, you know,
yeah.
it's like you know, it's, in fact, it is, sometimes it's excruciatingly not boring. It is painfully, agonizingly not boring because you get into these dilemmas with your characters. But so let's go back to the creation of Witchy Ways. And one of the things that I think is absolutely unique about Witchy Ways over virtually any other witch movie I've ever seen is really that meld of kind of the true Wiccan magic world and tying back in a little bit to the magical film world. How did you make that bridge, and what does that Earth Mother real philosophy behind it mean to you?
Well, you know, like initially, like I said, I just started researching and just discovered this world. And, you know, I wanted to accurately represent it because it hadn't been done yet. And I thought it deserved to be. So I did a lot of research. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways that people who identify as a witch, their spirituality varies depending on what type of witch they are. There's so many different variations on the witch. Dani's a green witch, so she's very rooted in the earth and nature and herbs and, you know, using herbs in her spells and things like that. But there's a lot of other kinds too. It's just very, very interesting. And everybody finds their own way. It's like for some people, it's a very personal creation, the spirituality. But a lot of things that it's rooted, that seem to be a through line, for instance, moon rituals, are also things that other people practice. And I've adopted a moon ritual. I do at least one a month, if either full or new, sometimes both. But by doing it, when I first started doing it, I was doing it just as research for the film. Like, what does this feel like? You know, what is the process of it? And then in doing it, I started understanding a little bit better the power it gives you, the self-empowerment that it gives you, the sense of self-empowerment and also the awareness of continually looking to grow and release negative things in your life and draw positive things back in. It's such a beautiful way of looking at the world. And so I started by going, okay, what are the real things that most witches kind of make part of their practice, and started adapting those into the story. And then as I went along, I had initially thought, I'm just going to write this so that she is just straight out a regular woman with all the powers that we could, each of us, have for ourselves. But then it is a film, and it, you know, it needs a little bit of sparkle. And so I started adding, you know, real effects of magic into it. And then as I went along, I just kind of fell in love with that aspect of it. So I worked really hard then to balance the magical, more fantasy elements of the film with the practical so that I didn't lose sight of the fact that Danny is a human being like anybody else living in, you know, she's living next door to people who are probably don't even know she's a witch, you know. So that was it was an interesting process. It was really actually a little difficult trying to decide how far I was going to go with it.
Well, it blended perfectly, in my opinion. It's like,
thank you.
And partly because I relate to a lot of the disciplines in it. Like the tarot card reading is, there is explanation behind it in the film. I mean, it's not just throwing cards out, but there's thought processes obviously involved. Talk to us about tarot cards and what those mean to you and what your research brought you to with those.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I used my beatboard on Final Draft, but I didn't use it as a beatboard. I used it more as just a storage space for ideas and my research. But I don't even remember now what their signs were, but each character had a sign, and imbued their character with the traits of the sign. I really got specific about that kind of stuff. And then tarot, obviously, it relates back to your astrology, your sign and your sun sign and all that stuff. But I knew what I wanted, the story I wanted to tell, so I actually worked backwards into the cards to make sure that the cards were helping to tell that story. But it is very interesting because I have a friend, I didn't know she was a witch, but I was talking to someone and said, give me a list of, you know, who are the LA witches? Who should I know? And her name was on it. And I was like, I mean, I had tea with this woman for several years before COVID. And never, like, we met regularly. She never brought it up, never said anything to me. But I called her. I was like, hey, I read you're a witch. And she's like, I am. And do you want to talk? I said, yeah. She's been practicing since she was 15 years old. Just doesn't, like a lot of people, just doesn't say it out loud if you're not part of the community. And I wanted her to read and give me script notes to make sure everything was accurate, but she was too expensive. So she's like, why don't we start with a tarot card reading? And I was like, oh, well, like, how does that work? And she's like, well, I can read a tarot card for your script. And I'm like, I didn't know you could do that. I thought it was just people-oriented. She's like, no, I can read the tarot for your script. And then that will help you with the story. Yeah. So I was like, okay, fine. So we did it. And when she turned the first two cards over, they were two queens, Queen of Wands and the Queen of Cups. And the card she was using, one of the women was surrounded by water, a little bent over, it was a very sad looking picture, but she was also a gorgeous, and she was a queen. So she said, this is your lead. This is your lead. This is Eve. She's surrounded by grief, but it's not drowning her. She's just in it, and she's going to find her way out. And the other card, the woman was dark skinned, very regal, very in her power. And she's like, this is your witch. And at the time, I had another actress in the role of the witch, and it was a white woman. And Miriam Hasler, who now plays Danny, she was supposed to play Eve, and she is part Trinidadian. So she's a mixed race. Oh, she got the ethnicities wrong, but all the descriptions, because she went on with the cards, and the description was perfect for each character. It was like weird that she had pulled that, but I was like, so that little part was wrong, so what? But everything else is absolutely right. And then the actress that was going to play Danny had to drop out, and Miriam said to me, why don't I take Danny, because it's a smaller role, and I only maybe get a bigger name, so more of a namey person for the role of Eve. And I was like, wait a minute, why didn't we do this in the first place? You are Danny. I mean, that's just better casting. And then I went out and I found Deora Baird, and I'd never seen her pop up before, but there she was, and she was screaming Eve. And it wasn't until months and months later, I was telling somebody the story, and I went, oh my God, those cards were right before they were right, because it ended up being absolutely specifically correct. It was crazy. It was crazy. It was just like, wow. And we had a lot of fun stuff on the, like, we had some witches on the set, so the cards, you know, got cleansed and cleared before somebody else handled them. And there was a lot of stuff like that, you know, that we did as we went along to honor the process that would normally be applied to these things, you know. And I will also say, I'm very pleased to say that there was a tarot card reader in the last screening at, I screened at Reeling in Chicago, and this guy said, oh, I'm a tarot card reader, and I just want you to know that you got the cards spot on. He said, so often, you know, TV and film get it wrong, and it's kind of disappointing when they do. He said, you got everything spot on. I was like, cool. So
don't
you know,
love it
research.
When your experience matches your fate? I mean, it's like when those two things come together, it's like, that's amazing and beautiful.
It is amazing.
Yeah. So tell me about the I hope I'm getting the name right, but the moon moth, that was a symbol that comes up throughout the film.
Yeah, the luna moth. Well, the luna moth.
Luna moth.
In my mind, acts as a sort of a spirit guide for Eve. Sort of represents her mother trying to help her to move through her grief so that she could move on, which is why she flies away when the mother's no longer contactable, you know. And so that luna moths are, and it says it in the film, but, you know, to become a luna moth, it takes almost a year, but and it goes through like a long process. And when it lives, it only lives for a couple of weeks. It doesn't eat. It just lives to, you know, create another luna moth. So there's this transformational aspect of the luna moth, which represents the transformation that truly both characters are going through, but it's applied specifically to Eve. The luna moth belongs with her. And it's just representative also of her transitioning into a different person, a freer individual, with a different future in front of her.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when you were making the film, which is ironic, and I hope I got this right, but because the film is set in some remote location and, you know, off in the boonies and everything else, but in reality, you filmed it in L.A., which I find, like, just sort of ironic. But also, you had some challenges with the weather and all that in that environment.
Yeah, it was crazy. Well, we shot it in Topanga, which, you know, honestly, there's like the houses are few, like they're spread really far apart. And some of the houses I actually looked at to shoot at owned like 20 acres. Like they people moved in the 60s and just bought up land. And then, you know, maybe they made the house bigger, but they kept all the land. And so the house was on a very large property, and the guest house was on the same property. So it, you can imagine how big it actually was. We could sort of see in the distance neighbors. So it had a little bit of that. It wasn't as remote as I had originally intended, but I don't think it matters to the movie so much. It's just about her isolating, you know, her going off somewhere to isolate. But we shot 2 years ago during the winter when, you know, that really bad rain came through, and we had shot 4 days in December and then offloaded and brought everything back in January. And we loaded in, and me and the DP and the makeup artist and Maram, Danny, who plays Danny, we were going to stay at the house. So we all moved in the night before in torrential rain. And I woke up the next morning at about 4:30 in the morning to my phone going off because all the roads into Topanga were closed. Nobody could get in. It was crazy, and we were trying to figure out alternate routes. And you know, when you're shooting a film over 13 days, losing a day is not good. There's nothing positive about that. So that turned into a big deal. But then on top of it, the driveway where we were shooting some of the scenes was a mud pit, so that couldn't be used for a few days. And my 80s car got stuck in it because the water had washed away and there was no gentle way into and out of the driveway. It just had this giant lip where the road was. And so she got stuck. So we had to shoot around her car, you know, and move the schedule. I mean, the weather itself was crazy. And then on top of it, you know, I had written in, so Danny has this almost uncontrollable power. When her anger gathers, storm clouds gather. She brings the storm, and it represents how she's feeling. And all of a sudden, we had, you know, storm clouds on days where she was happy. Like,
oh, no.
This is not what I was intending. But you know what? You get that kind of stuff, and then you just go, "What do? Okay, how do I make this work?" And I love rain. I write it into almost everything I ever do because I think it feels good. It's like moody. You can create anything you want out of that feeling. So we ended up writing a few extra lines when we shot at the forest, which was the last place we shot. We already knew all the days that we would have that we shot in the rain. And so I incorporated it into the last day to make sure that everything tied together. And then I made sure that, you know, the audience understood that Dani actually likes rain. It's a comfort for her. It's her protection, you know. So it worked out to be a positive, but there were a few moments where I was a little dag on it.
I mean, it all worked, yeah.
Yeah, it all worked. It all worked in the end. People pay good money for it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, if it had hit the script right, it would have been like you couldn't have asked for better. But and I'm not sure I have a question behind this, but just to say, the cinematography in this and the special effects and everything about that were just stellar. It is absolutely gorgeous. And one of the small details that I loved it. There's a point when they're on the phone with each other, and Gennady's character is doing a painting, and the painting is beautiful.
Uh-huh.
It's obviously just half done, but it just there's so many like little things in the movie that to me were just really brilliant subtext of the story and the whole. Fabric of it just holds together so perfectly,
like an
orchestra, all in harmony of the themes and the femininity and tying into the witchcraft with women power and all of those elements just kind of flow so naturally together throughout the whole film.
Thank you.
I do want to
put
it a little bit.
Wait, can I do one thing? I want to give a shout out. The artwork, and you can see it in the background while she's painting, you can see finished work behind her. That was my production designer, Milena Mortati, and she is an actual painter, and she's very, very talented. So I just want to give her a shout out.
Yeah, that stood out. I mean, it was, I think it was so effective because there was the finished art behind her, and she was obviously had to be somewhat close to the real artist because the painting she's working on is half finished and obviously, from the same artist. So that was like, wow, that was subtly intense. But I want to go to some housekeeping things. Where is the film going to be shown? How can people see it? And what is the future of the distribution of it?
Okay. So I am showing this Sunday in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. So obviously they said that their town has not been really, wasn't badly affected by the storm, but they are surrounded by towns that are devastated. So we'll see how it goes, but I'm glad to go there anyway and, experience the place. And that's Sunday at 6:45. And then we play in L.A. at a festival called La Femme Film Festival. It's a women's film festival, and that's on October 24th at 6 o'clock. And you can find all the information on my website, which is witchywaysmovie.com. And after that, we'll see. You know, honestly, I didn't set this movie up to play festivals. I see it as a commercial film. You know, it's for everybody, and it's I always saw it as, festivals have particular interests, and I've played the festival circuit quite a bit, and I understand how festivals work. I've programmed a festival before. I've been on the board of one, but my sales agent, I have a really great sales agent named Storyboard Media, and they were like, you might want to get some reviews, and so you can have pull quotes for your trailer and things like that. So they asked me to go back out, and we actually had no money left, So I just went to either places I'd played before, or I just did cold calls and asked for fee waivers. And some people were kind enough to grant them. But, you know, at this point, we take it to AFM, the American Film Market, in November and start selling it. And then we'll see what happens after that, whether I play more dates or not, or we start working on the release. But I expect that we would release sometime in the spring, probably.
Very good. I heard some thoughts that you're even working on a sequel to this. How's that?
I am working on a sequel. I am. I actually started thinking about it when we were shooting, and I'm still formulating what exactly is going to happen. It'll be a little bit darker than this one. I'll probably get a little scarier with it, but not a lot. It's going to involve a coven. That much I know. It might involve a good coven and a white coven and a dark coven. I don't know, but it's going to have a coven in it, and Candace is going to be at risk.
Well, I hope she overcomes and becomes the queen of the witches, and she deserves the queenship.
I think she would like that.
My fans.
I think she would like that.
If I was writing fan fiction for it, that's where I would take her. But
I should do that. I should set it up so that people can write in like their fantasy of what would happen if, you know, after they see the movie, what would be next.
Oh yeah, she's super powerful. So that would be awesome. So Jane, absolute pleasure. The movie is incredible and wonderful and rides just that beautiful spot of which lore that I think filmically we need. We are down to our last 3 minutes. What haven't we talked about that we should talk about?
Oh my gosh. I don't know. I just hope that everybody, you know, from a business standpoint, if somebody wants to go follow us at Witchy Ways Film on Instagram, it's the only place, it's the only presence we have because Facebook kicked me off for I don't know what. But I've had the worst time with Facebook. I just, Witchy Ways Film on Instagram. I'm actually thinking of doing a Substack or something and writing about the whole journey because this film was the hardest film I've ever done in terms of things going wrong. And, it was just up until we had the FBI involved in stuff and it was crazy. It was crazy. So
wow.
We'll see if I get around to doing that. Yeah.
Yeah. The end product is beautiful. So the whatever fire forged it, you definitely overcame. Beautiful piece of work. And that is it for us for today. So thank you, Jane, for everything you are and have contributed, and especially for coming on with us today. I want to thank Brody for his work on the show. And tell your friends and neighbors and even people you don't even like very much to subscribe and listen to the podcast. And tell your friends. Don't tell people you don't like. Anyway, we will be back again next week with yet another show. I have no idea what it is, but I do know that you will enjoy it. And we can't wait to talk to you then.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.